Chapter 20. Pitt and Stokes quickly became aware that they were in a no-win situation from the very start. They had little choice but to take off toward the south before banking on a 180-degree turn for Moresby Island to the north. The McDonnell Douglas Defender helicopter, manned by Dorset's security men, had merely to lift vertically off the ground in front of the hangar, turn northward, and cut in behind the slower float plane even before the chase shifted into first gear. The de Havilland Beaver's airspeed indicator read 160 knots, but Stokes felt as if he were flying a glider as they crossed the narrow channel separating the two islands. "Where are they?" he asked, without taking his eyes from a low range of cedar and pine-covered hills directly ahead, and the water only 100 meters below. "Half a kilometer back of our tail and closing fast," Pitt answered. "Just one?" "They probably decided knocking us down was a piece of cake and left the other chopper home."
"But for the extra weight and air drag of our floats, we might be on equal footing."
"Do you carry any weapons in this antique?" asked Pitt.
"Against regulations."
"A pity you didn't hide a shotgun in the floats."
"Unlike your American peace officers, who think nothing of packing an arsenal, we are not keen to wave guns around unless there is a life-threatening situation."
Pitt glanced at him incredulously.
"What do you call this mess?"
"An unforeseen difficulty," Stokes answered stoically.
"Then all we have is the 9mm automatic I stole against two heavy machine guns," said Pitt resignedly. "You know, I downed a chopper by throwing a life raft into its rotor blades a couple of years ago."
Stokes turned and stared at Pitt, unable to believe the incredible calm.
"Sorry, except for a pair of life vests, the cargo bay is bare. They're swinging around on our starboard side for a clear shot. When I give the word, drop the flaps and pull back the throttle." "I'll never pull out if I stall her at this altitude. Coming down in treetops beats a bullet in the brain and crashing in flames."
"I never thought of it quite like that," Stokes said grimly. Pitt watched intently as the blue-black helicopter pulled parallel to the float plane and seemed to hang there, like a hovering falcon eyeing a pigeon. They were so close that Pitt could discern the expressions on the faces of the pilot and co-pilot. They were both smiling. Pitt opened his side window and held the automatic out of sight under the frame.
"No warning over the radio," said Stokes disbelievingly. "No demand we return to the mine?" "These guys play tough. They wouldn't dare kill a Mountie unless they've got orders from someone high up in Dorset Consolidated." "I can't believe they expect to get away with it."
"They're sure as hell going to try," Pitt said quietly, his eyes locked on the gunner. "Get ready." He was not optimistic. Their only advantage, which was really no advantage at all, was that the 530 MD Defender was better suited for ground attack than air-to-air combat. Stokes held the control column between his knees as one hand embraced the flap levers and the other gripped the throttle. He found himself wondering why he placed so much trust in a man he had known less than 2 hours. The answer was simple. In all his years with the Mounties, he had seen few men who were in such absolute control of a seemingly hopeless situation. "Now," Pitt shouted, raising and firing off the automatic in the same breath. Stokes rammed the flaps to the full down position and slapped back the throttle. The old Beaver, without the power of its engine and held by the wind resistance against the big floats, slowed as abruptly as if it had entered a cloud of glue. At almost the same instant, Stokes heard the rapid-fire stammer of a machine gun and the thump of bullets on one wing. He also heard the sharp crack of Pitt's automatic. This was no fight, he thought as he frantically threw the near-stalling plane around in the air. This was a high school quarterback facing the entire defensive line of the Phoenix Cardinal football team. Then suddenly, for some inexplicable reason, the shooting stopped. The nose of the plane was dropping, and he pushed the throttle forward again to regain a small measure of control. Stokes stole a glance sideways as he leveled out the float plane and picked up speed. The helicopter had veered off. The co-pilot was slumped sideways in his seat behind several bullet holes in the plastic bubble of the cockpit. Stokes was surprised to find that the Beaver still responded to his commands. What surprised him even more was the look on Pitt's face. It was sheer disappointment. "Damn," Pitt muttered, "I missed."
"What are you talking about? You hit the co-pilot."
Pitt, angry at himself, stared at him. "I was aiming at the rotor assembly."
"You timed it perfectly," Stokes complimented him. "How did you know the exact instant to give me the signal and then shoot?"
The pilot stopped smiling. Stokes let it go. They weren't out of the storm yet. Broadmoor's village was still 30 kilometers away.
"They're coming around for another pass," said Pitt.
"No sense in attempting the same dodge."
Pitt nodded.
"I agree. The pilot will be expecting it. This time pull back on the control column and do an Immelmann."
"What's an Immelmann?"
Pitt looked at him.
"You don't know? How long have you been flying, for God's sake?"
21 hours, give or take."
"Oh, that's just great," Pitt groaned.
"Pull up in a half loop and then do a half roll at the top, to end up going in the opposite direction."
"I'm not sure I'm up for that."
"Don't the Mounties have qualified professional pilots?"
"None who were available for this assignment," Stokes said stiffly.
"Think you might hit a vital part of the chopper this time?"
"Not unless I'm amazingly lucky," Pitt replied. "I'm down to 3 rounds.
There was no hesitating on the part of the Defender's pilot. He angled in for a direct attack from above and to the side of his helpless quarry. A well-designed attack that left little room for Stokes to maneuver.
"Now," Pitt yelled, "put your nose down to gain speed and then pull up into your loop."
Stokes' inexperience caused hesitation. He was barely coming to the top of the loop in preparation for the half-roll when the 7.62-millimeter shells began smashing into the float plane's thin aluminum skin. The windshield burst into 1,000 pieces as shells hammered the instrument panel. The Defender's pilot altered his aim and raked his fire from the cockpit across the fuselage. It was an error that kept the Beaver in the air. He should have blasted the engine. Pitt fired off his final 3 rounds and hurled himself forward and down to make himself as small a target as possible in an act that was pure illusion. Remarkably, Stokes had completed the Immelmann, late to be sure, but now the Beaver was headed away from the helicopter before its pilot could swing his craft around 180 degrees. Pitt shook his head in dazed incredulity and checked his body for wounds. Except for a rash of small cuts on his face from slivers that had flown off the shattered windshield, he was unscathed. The Beaver was in level flight, and the radial engine was still roaring smoothly at full revolutions. The engine was the only part of the plane that hadn't been riddled with bullets. He looked at Stokes sharply. "Are you okay?" Stokes slowly turned and gazed at Pitt through unfocused eyes.
"I think the bastards just shot me out of my pension," he murmured.
He coughed, and then his lips were painted with blood that seeped down his chin and trickled onto his chest. Then he slumped forward against his shoulder harness, unconscious. Pitt took the co-pilot's control wheel in his hands and immediately threw the float plane around into a hard 180-degree bank until he was heading back on a course toward Mason Broadmoor's village. His snap turn caught the helicopter's pilot off guard, and a shower of bullets sprayed the empty air behind the float plane's tail. He wiped away the blood that had trailed into one eye and took stock. Most of the aircraft was stitched with over 100 holes, but the control systems and surfaces were undamaged, and the big 450 Wasp engine was still pounding away on every one of its cylinders. Now what to do? The first plan that ran through his mind was to make an attempt at ramming the helicopter. The old take-'em-with-you routine, Pitt mused. But that's all it could have been, an attempt. The Defender was far more nimble in the air than the lumbering Beaver with its massive pontoons. He'd stand as much chance as a cobra against a mongoose, a fight the mongoose never failed to win against the slower cobra. Only when it came up against a rattlesnake did the mongoose go down to defeat. The crazy thought running through Pitt's mind became divine inspiration as he sighted a low ridge of rocks about half a kilometer ahead and slightly to his right. There was a path toward the rocks through a stand of tall Douglas fir trees. He dove between the trees, his wingtips brushing the needles of the upper branches. To anyone else, it would have seemed like a desperate act of suicidal madness. The gambit misled the defender's pilot, who broke off the third attack and followed slightly above and behind the float plane, waiting to observe what looked like a certain crash. Pitt kept the throttle full against its stop and gripped the control wheel with both hands, eyes focused on the wall of rocks that loomed ahead. The airstream blasted through the shattered windshield, and he was forced to turn his head sideways in order to see. Fortunately, the gale swept away the trickling blood and the tears that it pried from his squinting eyes. He flew on between the trees. There could be no misjudgment, no miscalculation. He had to make the right move at the exact moment in time. A tenth of a second either way would spell certain death. The rocks were rushing toward the plane as if driven from behind. Pitt could clearly see them now, gray and brown jagged boulders with black streaks. He didn't have to look to see the needle on the altimeter registering on zero, or the needle on the tachometer wavering far into the red. The old girl was hurtling toward destruction just as fast as she could fly. "Low!" he shouted into the wind rushing through the smashed windshield. 2 meters low!" He barely had time to compensate before the rocks were on him. He gave the control column a precisely measured jerk, just enough to raise the plane's nose, just enough so the tips of the propeller whipped over the ridge, missing the crest by centimeters. He heard the sudden crunch of metal as the aluminum floats smashed into the rocks and tore free of the fuselage. The Beaver shot into the air, as graceful as a soaring hawk released from its tether. Unburdened by the weight of the bulky floats which lay smashed against the rocks, and with the drag on the aircraft decreased by nearly half, the ancient plane became more maneuverable and gained another 30 knots in airspeed. She responded to Pitt's commands instantly, without a trace of sluggishness as she chewed the air, fighting for altitude. "Now," he thought, a satanic grin on his lips, "I'll show you an Immelmann." He threw the aircraft into a half-loop and then snapped it over in a half-roll, heading on a direct course toward the helicopter. "Write your will, sucker!" he shouted, his voice drowned out by the rush of wind and the roar of the engine's exhaust. "Here comes the Red Baron!" Too late, the chopper's pilot read Pitt's intentions. There was nowhere to dodge, nowhere to hide. The last thing he expected was an assault by the battered old float plane. But here it was, closing on a collision course at almost 200 knots. It came roaring at him at a speed he didn't believe possible. He made a series of violent maneuvers, but the pilot of the old float plane anticipated his moves and kept coming on. He angled the helicopter's nose toward his opponent in a wild attempt to blast the punctured Beaver out of the sky before the imminent crash. Pitt saw the helicopter turn head-on, saw the flash from the gun in the pods, heard the shells punching into the big radial engine. Oil suddenly spurted from under the cowling, streaming onto the exhaust stacks and causing a dense trail of blue smoke to streak behind the plane. Pitt held up a hand to shield his eyes from the hot oil splattering against his face in stinging torrents from the airstream. The sight that froze in his memory a microsecond before the impact was the expression of grim acceptance on the face of the helicopter's pilot. The prop and engine of the float plane smashed squarely into the helicopter just behind the cockpit in an explosion of metal and debris that sheared off the tail rotor boom. Deprived of its torque compensation, the main body of the helicopter was thrown into a violent lateral drift. It spun around crazily for several revolutions before plummeting like a stone, 500 meters to the ground. Unlike special effects crashes in motion pictures, it didn't immediately burst into flames after crumpling into an unrecognizable mass of smoldering wreckage. Nearly 2 minutes passed before flames flickered from the debris, and a blinding sheet of flame enveloped it. Pieces of the Beaver's shattered propeller spun into the sky like a fireworks pinwheel. The cowling seemed to burst off the engine and fluttered like a wounded bird into the trees. The engine froze and stopped as quickly as if Pitt had turned off the ignition switch. He wiped the oil from his eyes, and all he could see over the exposed cylinder heads was a carpet of treetops. The Beaver's airspeed fell off, and she stalled as he braced himself for the crash. The controls were still functioning, and he tried to float the plane down into the upper tree limbs. He almost made it. But the outer edge of the right wing collided with a 70-meter-tall red cedar, throwing the aircraft into an abrupt 90-degree turn. Now totally out of control and dead in what little sky was left, the plane plunged into a solid mass of trees. The left wing wrapped itself around another towering cedar and was torn away. Green pine needles closed over the red plane, blotting it out from any view from above. The trunk of a fir tree, half a meter wide, rose in front of the battered aircraft. The propeller hub struck the tree head-on and punched right through it. The engine was pulled from its mountings as the upper half of the tree fell across the careening aircraft and knocked off the tail section. What remained of the wreckage plowed into the moist compost earth of the forest floor before finally coming to a dead stop. For the next few minutes, the ground below the trees was as silent as a cemetery. Pitt sat there, too stunned to move. He stared dazedly through the opening that was once the windshield. He noticed for the first time that the entire engine was gone, and wondered vaguely where it went. At last his mind began to come level again, and he reached over and examined Stokes. The Mountie shuddered in a fit of coughing, then shook his head feebly and regained a small measure of consciousness. He stared dumbly over the instrument panel at the pine branches that hung into the cockpit.
"How did we come down in the forest?" he mumbled. "You slept through the best part," Pitt muttered, as he tenderly massaged a gang of bruises.
Pitt didn't require 8 years of medical school to know Stokes would surely die if he didn't get to a hospital. Quickly he unzipped the old flying suit, ripped open the Mountie's shirt, and searched for the wound. He found it to the left of the breastbone, below the shoulder. There was so little blood and the hole was so small he almost missed it. "This wasn't made by a bullet," was Pitt's first reaction. He gently probed the hole and touched a sharp piece of metal. Puzzled, he looked up at the frame that once held the windshield. It was smashed beyond recognition. The impact of a bullet had driven a splinter from the aluminum frame into Stokes' chest, penetrating the left lung. Another centimeter, and it would have entered the heart. Stokes coughed up a wad of blood and spit it out the open window.
"Funny," he murmured. "I always thought I'd get shot in a highway chase or in a back alley. No such luck. How bad does it look?"
"A metal splinter in your lung," Pitt explained. "Are you in pain?"
"More of a throbbing ache than anything else."
Pitt stiffly rose out of his seat and came around behind Stokes. "Hang on, I'll get you out of here." Within 10 minutes, Pitt had kicked open the crumpled entry door and carefully manhandled Stokes' dead weight outside, where he gently laid him on the soft ground. It took no small effort, and he was panting heavily by the time he sat next to the Mountie to catch his breath. Stokes' face tightened in agony more than once, but he never uttered so much as a low moan. On the verge of slipping into unconsciousness, he closed his eyes. Pitt slapped him awake.
"Don't black out on me, pal. I need you to point the way to Mason Broadmoor's village."
Stokes' eyes fluttered open, and he looked at Pitt questioningly, as if recalling something.
"The Dorset helicopter," he said between coughs. "What happened to those bastards who were shooting at us?"
Pitt stared back at the smoke rising above the forest and grinned.
"They went to a barbecue."